Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Education Finance Committee. We will begin with approval of the minutes. And see, Representative Bennett, would you like to move the minutes from the March 4th meeting for approval?
I will, Madam Chair, but just one moment. I'll take a look real quick.
You bet.
Since I was talking too much here. Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Bennett. All right, and with that, we have three bills we're going to be hearing today. And I think, Representative Sundin, I've got you first on the list. Or if anyone has time constraints, we really don't have to take these in any particular order. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking for my testifier.
All right. If they are not here, we could certainly move to the next bill.
Oh. I have one.
All right. So are you prepared to move forward at this point, or should we wait?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So just to get your bill before us, I will move House File 996 to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, but it is the Chair's intent to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So with that, your bill's before us, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. 996 just provides for some permissive language for a school district in Barnum, Minnesota to move around a little bit of their early childhood family education money and their school readiness funds. There's a handout being circulated right now that shows some of the fund balances at the end of the year. And the superintendent of schools, David Bottom, is requesting that they can move that money around. I have one paragraph from Superintendent Bottom, and it reads something like this. Early childhood classes require parent participation. Due to parent work schedules and or transportation issues, participation is low in the early childhood program. School readiness, however, does not have a parent component, so as a result, we have a higher student participation requiring additional classes and staff. The Barnum School District would like the flexibility to use the money from either fund to better financially support all childhood education. And just a note on this, this has been heard in the Senate, and I understand it came through with flying colors, and you can expect another bill before this committee in the coming weeks, hopefully, that will address this issue statewide.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. But today in this event, I'm representing the Barnum School District. The superintendent and board member who were available earlier in the week to testify in the other body had to get back to school, and they'd taken off work. So they were so excited that they were lucky enough to get a hearing, but they really said, could I share their story for them? And I told them I could do that. They are looking at trying to provide the best possible program for their children. I know in the past I've talked about school readiness being a superintendent and board favorite. We reach out to lots of children. If you look at the handout, it's pretty clear that communities are sort of, some work with school readiness, some work with ECFE, and they really should let those funds flow between the programs so they're not carrying a large balance which doesn't go to kids. And so they're asking for flexibility with this account going forward through 18, and we would hope the committee would consider it as sort of a common sense way to provide better programs to their community.
Thank you. Do you have additional testifiers, Representative Sundin?
No, Madam Chair, I do not. This is a very small bill, self-explanatory, but thanks for the assistance there. I guess we'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. So just a question to you or to Ms. Kelleher. I think I heard you say that this is obviously pertains specifically to the Barnum School District, but that there would be a bill coming forward that would allow this flexibility for all districts. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, you did.
All right. So to Ms. Kelleher, I'm just wondering then, so this is an instance that is occurring more and more within districts in terms of the school readiness programs perhaps either being more popular or where more parents are choosing to place their children versus the ECFE option. Could you expound on that a little bit more? Because ECFE, I know, certainly requires a parent involvement component, and there's been a little bit of restructuring of some of those programs in the last few years, but could you talk about whether that's meeting the needs or what are we missing here if this is required at this time?
Well, Madam Chairman and members, I think today we're talking about school readiness and ECFE, and I think different communities approach it differently. Some are very successful with their school readiness program, which there is not a parental component. Especially in this area, the superintendent stressed that many families can't make the time for the parental ECFE requirement. As such, the choice he is faced with is either children don't get into an early childhood program or they're, you know, it breaks down because they don't have the parents in place. So there's sort of two key components in it, and they've almost hand-strapped districts going forward. So the flexibility would be great. I know 2 years ago we passed a bill which allowed some of our districts to transfer, or not all of our districts to transfer funds back and forth. That authority goes away June 30th. So I think we'll, you know, like to have you consider in a larger area what are the accounts you feel comfortable with school boards managing to get the best bang is that they can for their programs.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank both the author and the testifier and members of the committee. If you remember back, this is not the first time we've talked about allowing flexibility because of circumstances. We could have another school that might have it, you know, a different array, and next year it might change. So I really hope that we look at the possibility of how we could allow within the related area flexibility to address the actual students in utilization that they have. And I think that's what this bill is really helps us do, is see an example. We probably don't have the time to see all the possible examples, and it might be a different mix. But I like that this came before us because it lets us understand what's really happening to real kids instead of just a bunch of numbers. And again, thank you both for helping us have this conversation.
Thank you. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. of course, this is a necessary piece of legislation, and I applaud the author for bringing it to us. But I must say, you know, furthering this discussion that's permeated much of our work this session so far and will continue tonight, I assume, this notion of flexibility and this notion of transparency, it just seems rather odd to me that in the real world, a school board must announce to the citizens of the district ahead of time that public testimony is going to be taken to allow this transfer to occur. And I just can't imagine parents and the public attending these school board meetings in great numbers. And what has been in the real world, district by district, do you have any anecdotal information about just how many parents and citizens would attend these in the first place? Because if it's a really small number, in keeping with flexibility, we really should get rid of this requirement once and for all the districts.
Representative Sundin.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take a poke at responding to that. You know, in Barnum, Minnesota, where this many good ideas are spawned, we're dealing with a small number. But in some of the larger districts, okay, where the wholesale change like this, it could be a lot of money shifting around. And I think the safeguards are written into this for a good purpose. In the state of Minnesota, we have the highest number of attorneys per capita in the United States, and we don't want them getting our hands on this piece of legislation. So, thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sundin. Can we look at your handout here? Does this mean that, let's look at 2013-2014. As I look at this, I'm reading that 2013-14, you have an ECFE program with 28 students, and you have a fund balance in that program of 21,947. Okay. Then you also have in Barnum, with 35 students, a school readiness program. Those 35 kids, and they're running $12,682 in the red. So how do you want flexibility between those two programs and using the money in the best way possible? What happens to ECFE? The 28 kids, and how much of that money would go into the school readiness program?
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Madam.
We enacted your bill, your proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you take a look at that, those are running balances from 2012. The negative balance in 2012 under school readiness is 7,000 plus, and they're projecting it out 2015 is at $18,000. So those appear to be big numbers at the bottom, but that's a running total of what's the balance is. Am I correct?
Madam Chairman and members, Grace Kelleher, I believe that it's true that it's not how much the appropriation is in that account, Representative Murphy, but how much it's over or under, how much is it in debt, how much is it to the good. So it doesn't take in the exact appropriation itself, just whether it's high or low.
Representative Murphy.
But how do you get all those figures black with the number of kids that you have and underfunding or the under?
Madam Chair, the way I'm understanding it is if you look back to 2011-2012, the fund balance is there. The spread was 5,000 and 7,000. If we could transfer that $5,000, almost $600 into the school readiness, that would reduce that deficit down to, just quick math, $1,000. So it'd fund that program that much better, correct?
Madam Chairman and members, Grace Kelleher again. I think what would happen there, those children would still be served. You know, the students served really isn't, they wouldn't lose their service. This is those 29 are served with an additional 5,000 on top. So the superintendent here said it would be nice to flow that extra money, since we only have 29 students, into the school readiness where we have 59. So they would not lose service. They would still receive ECFE services.
Representative Murphy.
But Madam Chair, Ms. Kelleher, Representative Sundin, you're still going to be in the hole.
Representative Sundin.
Madam Chair, the Superintendent Bottom has also expressed the need for more money for the school district. So thank you for bringing that up.
Are we going, Madam Chair, in the two programs, are we going to equalize the amount of money that the student that's being served, the amount of money that is spent on those students being served?
Ms. Kelleher?
Madam Chairman, I know there are formulas that give us each one of those numbers for ECFE and for school readiness. Because of the demographics of this district, they are building a positive balance in their ECFE account while they're running pretty significant deficits serving kids in the school readiness account. Presently, the superintendent is covering those deficits from the general fund to continue to provide that program. He looked at the numbers and he just thought there's got to be a better way, and that's how this bill started.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, based on testimony that we just received, I think just passing 996 doesn't solve the problem. And so we should remember that for when we're talking in the future.
I would concur, Representative Murphy. Again, and I've got another couple of people on the list as well, but Ms. Kelleher, do you know, in terms of, do most districts receive or that their ECFE funding is far in excess of their school readiness funding currently? Or maybe that's a question for Mr. Strom. I can let you off the hook. Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, members, Ms. Johnson and I can get you some fund balance data for these two accounts within the Community Service Fund. I think it's important to point out that up until 2 or 3 years ago, there was a fund balance limit on the school readiness and the ECFE fund in an attempt to make sure more money from those funds was being provided directly as services. So those balances declined over the last 10 years by quite amount because of that fund balance limit. The legislature thought a couple of years ago that the individual fund balance limits were no longer necessary, so those were repealed. But the programs still are required by statute to be reserved accounts. And Ms. Johnson and I will give you a list of the relative amounts of those. Those are kept on the UPARS system. We certainly got those statewide through fiscal year 13.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Krishna.
I'm good.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when I'm looking at this data, it would appear that when you look at the students served and the participation rates, the school readiness certainly has a larger population than the early childhood family education programs. But I think more importantly, when we've looked at some of the spreadsheets and the different runs over the last several years here, I get a little concerned when I see the requirements of reporting year end or biennial end fund balances to MDE. And I hope we're not creating an atmosphere where our school districts feel a compelling need to expend that money in those buckets because it's accumulating, and have any fear or anxiety that the program dollars would be reduced because they're not utilizing it. I take a rather contrary view. I would really like to encourage districts to use that money to their wisest and best and most efficient use to deliver the program, and then therefore by not fearing that an accumulated balance in a certain program, as long as they're providing the program and having effective results, that they should actually be incentivized and rewarded by providing the flexibility that's being requested today to transfer some of those funds into another program where they could use a few more dollars without having to come to the state and ask for more money. So I think we could certainly do something to incentivize this, and this is an example of where in this particular district circumstance they have a fund balance left over after carrying out their ECF program, and now you're showing what has happened over the last 3 years where they have an accumulated balance and could more adequately use some of those dollars in school readiness and serve more kids and not be looking to increase the funding for the buckets, but just to use the money efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. And was there anyone else who wished to testify on House File 996? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozlan, and I represent the Minnesota Community Ed Association. And I actually don't want to speak to House File 996. I do want to just address a few questions that I heard during the testimony. Thank you, Representative Hertas, for your comments about the fund balance. I think there's a lot of questions about why districts have fund balances, and there's a lot of different reasons why a district might have a fund balance in their general fund and well as their other funds, and they may be there may be some money in the fund balance because for future purposes that they've highlighted as part of their ACFE plan, there's lots of different reasons. I know there's a specific situation in the Barnum District that Representative Sundin is trying to address. And then I just would certainly be remiss if I didn't remind the committee about the really chronic underfunding of school readiness. You know, school readiness received an appropriation increase last year. It was the first time since the school readiness programs in school districts have received an increase since the program began in the early 1990s. So while this bill addresses a specific issue in the Barnum School District, additional school readiness funding would help all school districts around the state provide school readiness programs. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions from committee members? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 996? All right. Any closing comments, Representative Sundin?
Just a thank you from myself, Superintendent Bottom, and 53 4-year-olds.
All right. Very well. Thank you. And with that, I'd renew my motion that House File 996 be re-referred to Ways and Means, that I intend to lay it over today for possible inclusion. And thank you very much. All right. Let's see. Representative Fisher.
Good afternoon, Chair Lewin.
Welcome, Representative Fisher. And I'll go ahead and move your bill to get it before us formally. I would move that House File 1110 be re-referred to Ways and Means, but with the Chair's intention of laying it over today. And with that, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Lewin and Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. This is a unique proposal that I'm bringing out forward today. It is to help address issues that we have in water in not only the East Metro, but eventually across the entire region. Is we know that we've got severe water shortages, and one of the big things that we found out as the DNR and everyone else has been working on it, that conservation is a big key that we have to look at. They're figuring that 17% of the problem could be figured by addressing better ways to use water and better conservation. And so locally, some things have sprouted up in the education world with the group H2O for Life and Race to Reduce has been working with our local school district to do some innovative things to help lead conservation efforts in a very unique way that not only tied locally as to what we're doing, but also showing that while we may have a water shortage here, how much surplus of water we have compared to other parts of the world. And so it's not just a local, but kind of an international effort as we're working with a variety of issues on water and how to use it more responsibly. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Superintendent Lovelett from the White Bear Lake School District, and then he'll make presentations of our presenters here also. With that.
Welcome. Please just state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Mike Lovett, School Superintendent, White Bear Lake Area Schools.
Thank you.
And with me today is Sophie Davis, a sixth grade student at Sunrise Middle School, and Mr. Ben Butters, a physical education teacher at Matoska International.
Thank
Madam
you.
Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce their stories very briefly. As superintendent of the White Bear Lake Area Schools, we serve all or part of 10 different communities in the Northeast metro area. They have two things in common, a school district and a great deal of water. One gem of water is the White Bear Lake, which for millennium has been a gathering place. When Europeans came over 150 years ago, it had been a very important community for Native American. It was really a very, very important place in their history. There are legends that come from that, mostly told to those of us who came later. But over the recent years, the last 10 years or so, it's become keenly aware of to all of us, and especially to our students, that there's something wrong with the lake. And so ask almost any student in the White Bear Lake area, and they'll understand what a closed basin lake is. they'll understand that, well, most lakes in most places are fed by watersheds. The White Bear Lake is fed by the upward pressure of the underlying aquifer. Our students are keenly interested in the causes for the depletion of the water and very interested in what they can do about it. Through partnerships with H2O for Life and Race to Reduce, we have remarkable stories all across our school district. We have indeed 15 sites and almost 9,000 students. But I thought a better way of telling the story would be to start with one story, with one student, and let Sophie Davis tell her story.
Hi, my name is Sophie Davis, and I'm a sixth grader at Sunrise Park Middle School. And last year, my school, Matoska International Elementary in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, partnered with Obwele Primary School and Irimu College Secondary School in Uganda for the H2O for Life program. Our job was to help raise awareness and money about the kids that don't have access to fresh water. Our school wanted to participate in H2O for Life because we think something needs to be done for the kids who walk miles every day just to get fresh water when kids in America complain about walking to the closest sink. Me and some other fifth graders at Matoska's job was to plan on how to raise money and get everyone super excited about helping the kids in Uganda. We met every Wednesday with our awesome gym teacher, Mr. Butters, to organize details, write lessons, skits, and plan an assembly. The assembly was used to help the other students learn about what we were doing as a school and what they need to do to help. Each student was to do extra jobs around the house or neighborhood to try to earn $7 to meet our school's goal. Anyone who raised money, even if it was only a penny, got to write their name on a water droplet and add it to our school's rainbow. At the assembly, there was a flash mob about how anything is possible, even raising enough money to help the schools in Uganda. And we did it. We raised over $4,000 to help the kids get fresh drinking water. It inspired so many kids at our school that anything really is possible. My favorite part was when we took action. My school walked from our gymnasium to White Bear Lake carrying 2 to 4 liters of water to symbolize what kids in Uganda have to do every day. My job was to encourage, help, and lead my school with our walk. Once we got there, we dumped all the water into White Bear Lake so it wasn't wasted and was helped to raise the lake. Because of H2O for Life, I'm now much more aware of wasted water. Before, I really didn't think about how I can go to any sink and get water at any time. Now I try to save water by simply taking shorter showers and turning off the water when I brush my teeth. I would like other kids in our community to know about the schools that don't have fresh water. I notice more when people waste water and think about it every day. That's why I think other people should be educated about how much we waste water. Maybe then it will not only make a difference in our community, but for the kids in Uganda too. Our school proved we can be open-minded, risk-takers, communicators, caring, and knowledgeable about the world, and that even one penny or one drop of water can make a difference.
Well, thank you, Sophie. I have to say, I think you're probably the youngest testifier we've had before this committee this year, and I think one of the best. You did a really great job. So your teacher is awesome, but so are you. So thanks for – did you work hard in practice on that before you did it today in committee?
Yeah, well, this is the second time I've made it, so.
Very well done. Thank you. All right. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
My name is Ben Butters, and it was my privilege to be Sophie's gym teacher for all her 5 years at Matoska. And over the course of my teaching career, I've learned what a tremendous responsibility I have teaching young people like Sophie the value of taking care of themselves and taking care of other people. As teachers, our goal is to develop lifelong learners in education, lifelong learners who take action. And Sophie is a great example of this. And I believe there are three main factors to reach this goal. The first is engaging students in meaningful connections with what they're learning to real life. That is why 550 kids from our school walked the mile carrying water and dumped it into White Bear Lake. And through our partnership with H2O for Life, we funded two wells that Sophie mentioned, and students were able to make these real-life connections to their learning. This is one example of a writing a fourth-grade boy wrote after the water walk. He wrote, "I think not many people know about what it's like to have to walk that far with that much weight in that heat. It is a good thing that many people chose to help. The water walk should be nationwide. Everybody should do the water walk. With this bill, our schools will be able to engage students in more of these meaningful connections. The second factor is empowering students to be leaders. When I sat down with Sophie and seven other students in the fall of 2013, I asked them what they wanted to do, and they had a lot of ideas. We want to help others in need, teach our students on how to care for our water, educate our students on the water crisis locally and globally, enlist the action of everyone to help. We met every Wednesday for an entire year learning about the issues and planning, as Sophie mentioned. This legislation will provide more opportunities to empower students to be leaders. The third factor is educating action. Action occurs in a cycle. Students choose, they act, and they reflect. One example of this is a choice would be I choose to conserve water. I don't let the water run when I brush my teeth. And then a reflection would be, I wonder if my parents let the water run when they're brushing their teeth. And this action cycle not only continues to create action, it also develops ownership in students' learning. Out of this legislation, educating students to take action will be the greatest result. Sophie is a great example of what kids can do when they are engaged in meaningful connections and are empowered to be leaders and are educated to take action. Through this bill, more and more students will be engaged, empowered, and educated on how to conserve water and help others in need.
Thank you very much. Do you have additional testifiers, Representative?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. I do have Paul Steinhauser from Race to Reduce here to talk a little bit more about the program itself. And one of the things that we did pass out in a handout is more detail about the initiative. That's several pages long. And also a press release telling more about the program from the H2O for Life.
Madam Chair and community committee members, allow me to describe, first of all, my name is Paul Steinhauser, and I'm the director of Race to Reduce, and that is a collaboration of all kinds of groups in the north and east groundwater management area that are working on the conservation side of improving the water situation there. So allow me to describe the desired outcome of all of these conservation members between students learning about this and teaching their parents about this and a concerted effort for us to upgrade residential and commercial water users with the latest water-saving technologies. There are billions and billions of gallons that don't need to get pumped from the aquifer, won't need to be purchased from surface water sources, and make no mistake, every gallon that is saved in these efforts will reduce the size and cost of whatever infrastructure eventually may be put in place to solve the water issues in the north and east groundwater management area. And every gallon that's saved will reduce the cost, the continual yearly cost for all of us. So we just think that this bill, starting with the students who then become the educators, will be the long-term solution to improving our water situation there.
Thank you, Mr. Steinhauser. Any additional testifiers at
this time? Any questions that the committee has?
All right. Representative Dabney.
Thank you. I think this is a question for the author, although I may be wrong. I see that Race to Reduce, maybe it's for Mr. Steinhauser, Race to Reduce paired with H2O for Life, which is a fine thing. I did a lot of work on Central America issues many years ago now, and so I understand the attraction of international work, but why not pair up with schools in the Central Valley of California that's experiencing a devastating drought, or schools in southwest Minnesota where, due largely to agricultural runoff, none of the lakes and very few of the streams have been found by the MPCA to be safe for fishing or swimming?
Well, to answer that, the truth is White Bear Lake is the canary in the coal mine for a much broader situation that you're talking about, and you're right. We're looking at White Bear Lake, but look at southwest Minnesota, look at California, look at the world. What Race to Reduce, we're teamed with H2O for Life specifically so that they're in the schools educating about water. But Race to Reduce itself is about figuring out how to implement, as I mentioned, the latest water-saving technologies and then duplicate that and expand it, because the amount of water that we waste is unbelievable, and we could change that without any lifestyle change. The biggest lifestyle change would get people to water their lawn before 9 in the morning. But if you think about our water use, and I don't want to get too carried away here, but you know, the state is full of houses that were built before 1984 and flush 5 or 7 gallons 6 or 7 times a day per person to remove 6 ounces of fluid. It's hard to think of where else we waste more, and again, could change that without any lifestyle change at all. So Race to Reduce is focused on that, starting right around White Bear Lake, because we thought that would be the pilot. It's White Bear Lake, Montemedi, and Birchwood is the pilot, and then we would like to expand the program to all other communities in Minnesota and beyond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
Additional questions? Representative Hertas.
Thanks. I just wanted to make a comment. When we do residential development, part of the engineering standards are we use a formula based on a normal occupant load, and we base that on about 100 gallons per occupant. So a typical household has 2.6 occupants, and so we calculate 260 gallons of effluent coming from that house. And then you multiply that times the number of lots that you have in a new subdivision, and then you come up with the size of pipe that's necessary to build that out. So I've recently, it's funny we're talking about this, there was something on the news last week talking about water, and I said to my wife, I said, well, let's kind of work this through. So we kind of did some math, and we found out that the two of us living alone as empty nesters are far below that quantity, but nonetheless, you think about regular daily activity, and if each of us would just do that and kind of think about how you efficiently use water, whether it's necessary to run as many loads of laundry or one that run the dishwasher as often, all of those things all make the difference. Thank you.
That's true. Actually, today in Minnesota, the average is about 95 gallons per person. The Met Council has set a target for us of getting down to 75 per person.
The Met Council has a way of managing our lives, yes.
That's another story.
Additional questions? Or Representative Fisher, did you want to comment?
No. I see Representative Murphy has a.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Butters, how did you, gym teacher, get involved in a program like this?
Mr. Butters.
H2O for Life is a great organization, and it has been it's founded in White Bear Lake, and I just think water is a very important thing. I mean, I get asked every day, Mr. Butters, I need a drink. I think water is the soul. I mean, we need it. Everyone needs it, and it's very important, and I just think it's important.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, then H2O for Life is the pusher in this program or in this request, and they're working through the school district and the organizations within the school
for their goals. Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, they're involved with it, and I do have the one of the folks from H2O Life here also who could also help answer questions, but it's being really led more by the Race to Reduce. They are connected very closely with H2O for Life. It's kind of a partnership that's occurring there, and this is one of the great things that we've seen in our area, is we've seen more and more people coming together about concerns about what's happening with water and how it can be more broad-based and conserve about it. We've had the Chamber of Commerce involved with different efforts, which eventually involved with people from H2O for Life getting together with Race to Reduce, which connected with our school districts to help people figure out better ways that we could go about using our water. So it's more of a collaboration and a partnership that's kind of happened with organizations that were already present in the district, where we had a unique opportunity that we had these resources already present that started matching up together.
And Madam Chair, it seems to be working with the inspiration that Ms. Davis gave us. Is there a possibility that if everyone buys into this, Mr. Butters, that, Madam Chair, that the lake is going to be up to the right levels in the near future?
Mr. Butters or Mr. Steinhauser?
I think the answer to that, there's the science going on in the studies right now about White Bear Lake and the underlying aquifers, and the answer, no one really knows how fast or if the lake level will come back, and so I'm sure you've read that there are all of these suggestions on different ways to solve the problem, and they go from tens of millions of dollars to hundreds of millions of dollars, and all we're saying is whatever ends up being the solution will be less costly if we start conservation measures and really bring that to light first.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could also lend a couple comments on it too, is this is a problem that's not just in our local area around White Bear Lake, but throughout the entire region, and not just the region of the East Metro, but also the entire metro area. We have, according to the reports from the DNR and from the Met Council, is that our aquifer underlying us is dropping consistently throughout the area, and at a certain point, some of the communities are going to have problems pulling enough water out of that current aquifer that we're using. The biggest part is that a lot of it is water that we could be using more efficiently. Most of it is used during the summer when we're irrigating our lawns. And I think where this comes more of a big presence is as we start learning from a very young age how to better use our water and better ways to use it, we get conservation that may not necessarily always bring the lake back up, but starts taking the pressure off of what we're doing on the underlying aquifer and our other surface water resources that we have going by. So it's about learning to do things a little differently.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, additional questions? Mm-hmm. Nope. All right. Any other questions? Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? All right. Any closing comments, Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. One of the things I would like to say, first of all, is thank you for the opportunity to present the bill today. I've asked that you please give it consideration. And it does have an impact. The last part of the story I'd like to add is when my kids were in grade school back more years ago than I'd care to admit to, they had gone through ecological part in their science class where they came home and were bugging us daily about how much water we were using and brushing our teeth, etc. And it's when you've got your kids in front of you making a plea on a regular basis, it's really hard to ignore. And I got to tell you, we changed how we've done it. We've changed how much we used at our house. We changed how we changed the patterns of watering in our yard, etc. So it's something that it turns out that the youngest among us are able to teach us once they have the tools, and I think this is probably one of the greatest ways to do it because it becomes generational, and I think this is a great way to tie us all together and to be able to use our water resources more efficiently. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Actually, I want to ask Ms. Davis to step back up for 1 second.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Davis, did you get your parents to turn off the water while they're brushing their teeth as well?
Yeah.
I thought maybe you did. Very well. Well, you've done a great job today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1110 be referred to Ways and Means, but I'm laying it over for today for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Fisher.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, and Representative Schultz. All right, well, welcome, Representative Schultz. We appreciate you coming today, and I will move your bill to get it before us. I would move that House File 1344 be referred to Ways and Means, but the Chair's intention today is to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Well, and, thank you.
Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Today I'm presenting a bill for an appropriation for the Duluth Children's Museum. This is an appropriation for $100,000 each year of the biennium, and it is for STEM educational programs and for exhibits. And as you probably know, as a country, we're falling behind other countries in educating children in the STEM areas. As an educator myself, I teach a field that requires a lot of mathematics and in higher ed, and I feel that we're not doing an adequate job of training kids, and we need to start at an early age. So I think this bill will help address the importance of science education and get young people the tools they need to get interested in STEM fields and make it easier for them to learn those fields once they get into institutions of education. And I brought three testifiers with me today, so if it's okay, maybe we can start with their testimony.
Absolutely. And whoever wants to go first, and I would just ask each of you to just clearly state your name for the record at the beginning of your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cameron Bloom Kruger. I'm the President and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum. And with me today are Michael Garcia, Senior Consultant and retired CEO for the Duluth Children's Museum, who will be speaking on the history and background of STEM education at the museum. And Kyle Terrio Johnson is our Board Chair-elect and a financial advisor. And he's seen and witnessed the wonderful ways the museum has ignited a passion in the lives of children and would like to speak on behalf of that. I'd like to begin by introducing Michael Garcia to speak on our history.
Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Garcia, and it's my privilege to be here today. My first testimony before the Minnesota Legislature was on an educational issue, actually in 1970 when I was a student in Virginia, Minnesota. And I bring that up because I was so amazed by the young woman who testified. I didn't think of myself doing something out of the ordinary in 1970 when we were asking the legislature to suspend graduation requirements to allow our school to add electives in English education. Today, my purpose in being here is really a bit of a swan song. As Cameron indicated, I am retiring from the Duluth Children's Museum after 12 years of service and over 20 years of board and volunteer service because of issues of imminent health. But my real reason for being here today is looking at the future of the Duluth Children's Museum, our community, and the museum's ability to partner in STEM education in a meaningful and deep way that affects young people throughout the Duluth community, the region, and the state. The children who compose the Duluth Children's Museum have demanded of us over recent years that we expand our programming and include things that go beyond culture and the arts, which we have always had a strength in. The Children's Museum was established by an arts educator, Mabel McKinney Wing, in 1930. It is the fifth oldest children's museum in the nation and the first children's museum in the state of Minnesota. Recently, as we branched out into STEM education, the rationale for doing so became apparent to us as we began to try to be more relevant to today's young people and the needs of the students in Minnesota. Very recently, we were approached by an organization called NISNET, the Nanoscience Informal Education Network, of which the Minnesota Science Museum is a regional provider. The Duluth Children's Museum partnered in order to test an experiment to see if you introduced engineering concept in pre-education, preschool education students, if you could influence them over time. The NICE network was the largest funded public partnership of NSF in the country's history. We participated in that program for over 6 years, and we had thousands of students and visitors participate in the NISENET experience. And we, in fact, know today, through the research and measurement that was conducted, both pre- and post-surveys, that the experience and the exhibit that we brought and the programming that companioned it did have an impact on those young students' lives. I know it's a concern of the committee and all of us that there is gender equity and gender opportunity in STEM education. Children's museums are uniquely positioned to provide services to young girls and to the women who are raising the young girls. We are very proud and pleased that we partnered with a program called ARISS. It was the Amateur Radio International Space Station project, where young students got to get licensed in ham radio operation and then made contact with the International Space Station last summer as it flew over Minnesota and while it was in range. I'm pleased to report to you that over 70% of the students participating were girls, and the majority of them went on to get their ham radio license. Nothing thrilled the members of the Ham Radio Club more than that, because quite frankly, at my age, I can say they were a bunch of older white men, older than me, and I'm retiring. So we are doing our job in terms of including girls, recruiting girls, and influencing the lives of the young people. Most recently, the Duluth Children's Museum had an opportunity to participate in a program that you have a press release before you, and Cameron's going to say a bit more about that. But it started prior to Cameron's employment with us, and it's called SSEP. This is a science experiment national network of opportunities, and the Duluth Children's Museum was the first community-based organization in the nation to be selected to partner with formal education to have students design experiments and go through a procedure of competitive elimination in selecting three experiments that will make it to the International Space Station. Very pleased and proud to report to you today that one of those experiments came from a group of senior students at Marshall High School in Duluth, Minnesota, who in partnership and support from the Duluth Children's Museum developed their experiment, participated in the competition, and were awarded the opportunity to have their experiment go to the International Space Station. We'll be holding a public event on that activity next week, and I'm sorry it's while you're in session, because I'd love to have many of you attend and be there, but encourage you to watch the media coverage on that event. Those are just some of the examples of the programming that we offer that supports STEM education. One of the more unique things about the Duluth Children's Museum that really makes that organization special, and that harkens back to my experience growing up in Virginia, Minnesota, and my first experience with the Duluth Children's Museum, is that it is an artifact and collection-based museum, unlike most children's museums. Only four children's museums in our country are artifact and collection-based. The Duluth Children's Museum has over 35,000 objects, many of which are science, STEM, engineering, and math related in their nature and in their content. That rich collection allows us to educate and touch the lives of young people, not only that visit the museum, but throughout the region. When Ms. Wing founded the museum, one of the things that she did is make available to educators across the entire region the school boxes, and I had a science teacher who wrote a letter to her, and that teacher was teaching on rocks, gems, and minerals. And so in the 1950s, in James Madison Elementary School, where I went to school in Virginia, Minnesota, the day I will never forget in my life is the day the box arrived in the mail from the Duluth Children's Museum with a letter from Miss Wing that explained the objects in there and the rocks and the minerals and gems. 60 years later, I'm testifying about that before you. The reason I'm bringing it up today is because that is the kind of life experience that the Duluth Children's Museum offers the young people from our entire state and our region that they will carry with them for a lifetime. I'm pleased and proud to be a past member of the staff of the museum. I'm very honored and privileged to be a member of Minnesota and a resident of Minnesota, and to have been before the legislature on so many educational issues over the last 45 years. I thank you for your service and your support. Turn it back to Cameron, and we'll stand for questions later.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hill.
I'd like to thank Representative Schultz, and I should have done this earlier, and the committee for taking the time to hear this, and the representatives who have supported this bill. It's been really, really exciting to see how quickly representatives were able to get behind this, because it is so important to our region, and the support has been absolutely energizing. HF 1344 is a request for $100,000 each year in the biennium, and what we're looking at doing is strengthening the breadth and depth of our STEM programming. We have already offered a significant amount of programming, including the SSCP program, which if you think about being a high schooler and sending frog embryos into space, which is the project that was selected for this, just imagine how cool that is, how we can really bank on the experiment itself, the design, the process, scientific inquiry, and use this entire educational system related to STEM to do all the programming that we do, and talk to elementary school students and to high school students, to preschool, in their classrooms and in the museum about this scientific process and how it led to frog embryos being launched into space, which is really fun to say, by the way. With your support, we'll not only serve the 35,000 individuals who currently visit the museum on an annual basis, but we have the opportunity to increase our classroom presence, where we can supplement STEM education that's already happening, and allow for field trips to the museum to provide supplementary STEM education within the museum. We also hope to have STEM-based exhibits, certainly each summer, providing an additional supplementary education and staff who can facilitate that learning experience, which is absolutely important for the summer learning gap that exists in our community and with the families that we serve. We want to provide a very educational, interactive, and fun experience, and use STEM as this basis because it is so important to educating and growing great young minds. Now, somebody who can talk more about great young minds is Kyle Terrio Johnson, who is our board elect, and I'd like for him to share a bit about what he's seen at the museum.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm honored to testify and support this request from the Duluth Children's Museum for additional dollars to support our science, technology, engineering, and mathematics initiatives. I'm a father of two small children who have learned great things at the museum, and they've benefited greatly from the programming that we offer. We learned at the museum that the current crop of astronauts are getting old, and that the next astronauts that NASA plans to train up and get into space are in third grade. I have a third grader. While I delight in the reaction of my own children when we visit the museum, I'm especially proud and committed to the continuation of the access programs that ensure these learning opportunities are open to every child who is able to attend. My role today is to encourage your support of House File 1344 and to thank you for your past and future investment in all children of Minnesota. And I thank you now. I'll turn it back over to Cameron to close.
Thank you. Was it Mr. Johnson?
Kyle Terrio Johnson.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair. We ask not for ourselves and the museum, but we ask for the thousands of children who have the opportunity to be served by programs with the museum, and not just at the museum, but in classrooms and in outreach programs, in after-school programs, and everywhere else that we can possibly bring the collection and bring the expertise that we've developed in 85 years of existing as an important community resource. We ask that the committee support this bill moving forward, and with that, I'd like to thank Madam Chair and the committee for hearing us out today, and I'd welcome any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Blumkruger. I appreciate all of the great testimony we've heard. I do have a few questions of people on the list. Representative Bennett, I think you're the first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our presenters. This sounds like a wonderful program, and I just would like to ask you, how many exhibits would you think you'll be able to add with this grant, and how many annual visitors might that bring?
Mr. Blumkruger.
Madam Chair, so absolutely, traveling exhibits has become a very important part of what we've done, simply because larger museums than ours can fabricate really amazing pieces that then we have the opportunity to rent and bring into our facility. But we also have the capacity and the creativity to construct elements of exhibits that we can host and keep all of the time. And if those exhibits are no longer useful to our museum, we have the opportunity to share those exhibits with other museums in the region through a network that we're connected with. So we have a lot of opportunity through this funding to be able to provide more of that. How many exhibits, how many elements? Certainly one large exhibit each summer has been very effective for us. The increase in visitors, what we can look back to is when we hosted Dinosaurs Unearthed, which was a very phenomenal paleontology exhibit with moving parts and dinosaur bones and many other things that were interactive, and saw a large increase in visitorship. And I wonder if Michael Garcia, well, he was there at that time, may actually have some more insight into that.
Mr. Garcia?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. I believe that, as Cameron said, it would be one exhibit annually that we would add to the rotating exhibit through this funding. And then the increased visitorship, I would estimate to increase the annual attendance by approximately 12,000 individuals that come through the museum doors. What we don't have is a quantified number of the opportunities for school tours and school groups, but on the map that you have before you, you see that our membership spans the entire state of Minnesota, and we have visitorship annually from all 50 states and from three countries last year, more countries, I think eight countries the year before that. And so the school bus opportunity with STEM education, with a focus on an educational program package that appeals to educators and extends what they can do in the classroom, is likely to bring upwards of 5,000 to 8,000 additional students annually to the museum.
Representative Bennett. Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm curious, is this in addition to the MDE rider that has been going on for years for $100K a year?
Mr. Garcia.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yes, this is an additional bill. The $50,000 that we've had in place for, I believe, 8 years now is a specific initiative to provide what Mr. Johnson was referring to, which is the access program for low-income households in our region. The Duluth population in the area that is served in the Duluth area has a disproportionate level of low-income households considering its location and its demographics. The $50,000 annually that we've received previously has been dedicated to scholarships for families, particularly those that partner with Head Start or ECFE throughout the region, and that provides membership access for those families annually to our museum as well as to all of the cultural institutions across the state and the country. So it is a supplemental bill.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that $50,000 for the scholarships, how many memberships is that equivalent to?
Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that serves 330 households. But when you do the multiplication on the math, it's not limited just to households. Some of it is child care providers that specialize in low-income household services and things. So the number of people who receive membership services through that program are in the rough area of approximately 9,000 young people, and their adult caregivers are covered by that program.
Madam Chair. I just wanted to add to that to say that we believe in access for all, and that's really true to our mission. And our partnerships with nonprofit organizations is a large part of that Passport to Culture program and the opportunity for more people to access programming. So just wanted to add that.
Our Representative
Kwan. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. So it's a little over a quarter of the membership are supplied by that MDE rider. And I'm trying to understand the justification of having the carve out for one location or region versus, if you look at the southeastern part of the state, that's actually the third largest city, which is 20 to 25% greater in population, but the demographics are much younger because there's twice the enrollment in that district. And, instead of continuing this carve-out, we might look at the possible outreach that dollars could do in a region that has, the population growth for children that could be, availed of this capability. And I understand and appreciate the regional significance of some of the exhibits, but there's 150, 200 years worth of medical science memorabilia that would be available if we actually had the space to display that, along with other things. So when we do look at this, we should look at the state and where there might be appropriate support by need and area, because the free and reduced lunch proportionalities and percentages for that twice as many students is approximately the same. So I'm just looking at this. So when we're looking at carve outs, we look at the global picture, and there are a lot of good stories, and look at the budget and address it as a global vision and not just the ones that were able to be heard before the committee.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kwan. I think that's a great idea. I think we should work on getting those services in that area, and maybe we can work with the medical Mayo group down there to maybe joint finance something like that, or maybe we can even expand out in that area for the Duluth Children's Museum. But we do have a unique population, lower income than Southeast Minnesota, and it's harder for our young individuals to get down to the metro area to take advantage of the Minnesota Children's Museum and the Science Museum. And so we're at a real disadvantage being up in Northeast Minnesota and serving a much larger geographic area that's more dispersed. But there are separate requests from the Minnesota Children's Museum for $1 million over the biennium, in addition to the funds they get through the MDE and the legacy funds. So you are probably going to see other requests, individual requests from other institutions.
Thank you. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a good segue. Thank you, Representative Schultz and Representative Kwan, because I'll be carrying the bill for the Children's Museum here in St. Paul, the bill for legacy funding and also for the education funding. So that leads into my question. I was wondering, is there going to be a bill that, because I'm on the legacy committee, a bill that the Duluth Children's Museum will be bringing forward for legacy funding? I'm just curious.
Mr. Garcia?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Duluth Children's Museum has been a beneficiary of the Legacy Committee for the entire time that the Legacy Amendment has been in place. I had the privilege of serving on the Framework Committee for the cultural part of that, reporting to Representative Murphy and to the legislature. We are currently a subgrantee of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and while we are not embedded in their legacy request, the funds that are awarded from the Legacy Amendment are awarded to the Minnesota Humanities Center, and then Children's Museums Grand Rapids, Mankato, and Duluth compete for those funds through a competitive grant process that's administered by David O'Fallon's staff at the Minnesota Historical Society. That has varied over the life of the amendment, and we're unclear as to how this session will turn out at this time.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Garcia, for that. And I'm sure we'll continue the discussion in the Legacy Committee and see what we can do to help.
Absolutely.
Additional questions? All right. Representative Schultz, do you have any additional testifiers?
I should have brought my two sons, Otis and Lewis, who are members of the Children's Museum along with the rest of my family. They really enjoy the programming that the Duluth Children's Museum brings to other venues and has gotten them interested in space and science, and they just went to the Science Museum space exhibit. So hopefully they'll go into science or STEM, and we really look forward to providing additional services in STEM if this funding goes through. So thank you again, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for listening to this bill.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Mr. Heller, I'll allow you a minute or two very briefly. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Loon, on the House Education Finance Committee, and members, for this opportunity to speak. My name is Rick Heller. I'm unofficially representing the Twice Exceptional and Print Disabled. Today's a great day, especially. The day yesterday was for the blind and blind deaf. There's currently something up here, if anybody's interested. It specifically notes it's a radio station from State Services of the Blind that talks about the blind and print disability. Anybody's welcome to engage in that. They'll borrow it out to you. Okay, now, so speaking on perhaps this bill today, 1344, is that correct?
That's correct.
I'd like to read out loud a correspondence I shared in Innovation Committee. Currently, I believe it's online, fully accessible, thanks to this House Research Department. I'm going to read the correspondence out loud, and I think it's relevant, because I find the word legacy in this language here that they handed out today. And it's probably, even though it might be, I testified in a different legacy committee, so you could stop me anytime if you wish. This is available. I ask that you'd reflect that in the minutes, if not, post it online as well. I think this is relevant when Minnesota passes out a lot of money, millions, to third-party individuals. Perhaps when I read this out loud, you understand the relevance.
Mr. Heller, do you have testimony pertinent to the Children's Museum?
I'm going to testimony rate. I'm going to read this letter. Dear Mr. Heller, again, this is from Mary Mullen, House Research Department, electronic message sent on February 25th, 2015. You recently asked questions at the Minnesota House Legacy Hearing Committee, and I wanted to follow up with you on information on your request. I've reached out to TPT, MPR, and AMPERs to request information from them on the accessibility standards and web accessibility, and I plan to forward that to the committee chair of the committee and to use as soon as I have it. I've wanted to let you know that state agencies are required to meet certain accessibility standards based on statute, Minnesota, section 16E.03 SUBD.9 requirements. State agencies to comply with certain national technology accessibility standards.
All right, Mr. Heller, I'm going to stop you right there. I appreciate what you're sharing with the committee, but it's not pertinent to the specific bill. So with that, we'll bring you back another time to talk about accessibility and that, but it's not pertinent to this funding request for the Duluth Children's Museum.
Madam Chair, the question is to this agency, third party, when we hand money to them, the question could be up to the members to ask the question that they have a strategy or a goal to work toward content accessibility for individuals that are required under state agencies to follow. And I would respect that somebody in the committee could ask that question if they choose to. However, obviously, according to the people in research, they don't have to. So.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Heller. And I'm actually going to allow Mr. Blum-Kruger to respond, because I assume that you do have exhibits and accommodations for visitors who may need that at your museum.
Madam Chair, this is an incredibly important issue to me personally, and I feel that the museum can continue to do better in this area, but our exhibits, our staff are trained in order to work with a wide variety of individuals who visit the museum. We're about sensory, we're about providing an experience, and that experience is open to everyone, and that's very important to us.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I appreciate you raising that question, Mr. Heller, and we will continue to have those concerns in mind, and if there's another bill that comes forward specifically on that, I'll make sure that you are here to testify again.
Actually, Madam Chair, I don't believe that's my responsibility. My responsibility here is to testify, and the leaders choose to start considering a strategy plan when third-party vendors come in. Again, it's not my responsibility. I'm asking the leadership to take responsibility for this. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, Representative Schultz, any final comments?
No, none. Thanks again, and I just renew my motion. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you to all your testifiers. And with that, House File 1334 will be re-referred to Ways and Means, but I am laying it over today for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all. And with that, we are adjourned for today.